I'm Donna. I'm the Spiritual Programs Coordinator at Kadampa Center. If you're not familiar with Jonathan Landa, he has been a student of Buddhism since 1970 when he first met Lama Yeshe up there to the right of His Holiness, who was the founder of our mother organization, FPMT. Tonight he's going to be teaching about on the foundation of all good qualities. If you would like a copy of the text, it's on the table that was there as you came inside the door. John will also be here. He's here on a two-week visit. He's going to be leading a weekend workshop this weekend on the seven-point mind training, which is a text that has instructions for making ourselves happier by developing the altruistic mind. He's also going to be teaching next Monday night the first class in the Discovering Buddhism class on how to meditate, a second session of this class next Wednesday, and then on Thursday night about making pilgrimage to Buddhist holy sites. And then on Saturday of the following weekend on the life of Shakyamuni Buddha, and he's also teaching our Sunday morning session, so it's going to be quite a full visit. Just a reminder, if you are not familiar with how we do things at Kadampa Center, everything that we offer at the center is completely supported by donations, because we feel these teachings are far too important to let money ever be an obstacle to anybody hearing these teachings. Of course, we still live in the real world and have expenses involved. So we would be very grateful if you are moved by what you hear tonight or at any time during John's visit, if you wish to make a donation to support covering our expenses during his visit. Thank you very much, and he should be in any minute.
So in order to prepare the most conducive motivation for the session that we have together, I'd like to recite one time in Tibetan the prayer for refuge in generating the precious bodhicitta mind. And after that one recitation in Tibetan, then I would like to do the end of it three times in English.
And that is on page, if you're not familiar with it, 34 of the Gold Prayer Book.
Sangin chudam zogi chonam lan janju pardu tagni kyapsu chi dagi jin zogi pe sonam gi drola penchir sange rupasho.
I go for refuge until enlightenment and to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. From the virtues merited that we could by practicing giving and other perfections, may we attain the state of a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. May we attain the state of a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. May we attain the state of a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. So evidently the version that I had memorized is slightly different from the version that you had. Okay. So thank you everyone for being here this evening. And the short text that I've been asked to make some comments about is by the founder of our tradition, Lama J. Tsongkhapa, and it's called The Foundation of All Good Qualities. And it's one of the shorter versions of the Lamrim that he that he composed. Of course, he composed the great treatise of exceptional length, but he also, he and his followers also composed shorter versions for meditative purposes or for memorization purposes. And this, the foundation of all good qualities, is one of the most popular. I have, before I begin, has this particular teaching been given here recently, the foundation of all good qualities?
Not recently.
Not recently. Okay. And then I mentioned that this text is a short version of the literature known as Lam Rim, or Stages of the Path. Can I see by a show of hands how many people, for how many people that this term, Lam Rim, or Stages of the Path, is rather new, something you're not terribly familiar with? Oh, very nice. I'm very happy to see that. And you're most welcome here. And then how many people have, who are here, have received Lam Rim teachings in the past? Okay, it's fairly evenly divided. That's good. I'm happy with that. So, welcome all you veterans. You can correct my mistakes. And welcome all you new people. You might not notice the mistakes. even though this is a rather short text, I think you... Seems like you have copies of it at your seats. Yeah, it's not very long. It's just, I think, something like 12 or 14 stanzas.
You don't have a copy. It's on the table as you come in the door.
Mm-hmm. So even though it is relatively short, and even though we're going to have two sessions devoted to it this week and next week, I probably am not going to give even weight to each of the stanzas. Rather, I'm going to look at each one and make comments either longer or more briefly on each one as it seems fit, as it seems appropriate. Okay? So this, not only because of the lack of qualities on the side of the teacher, this won't be a complete official commentary, but also because of the way it's being divided up, it'll be a little bit focusing more deeply on certain aspects and not quite as deeply on other aspects. But hopefully we'll get a general overview of it. Now, the part of teaching in a situation like this that I myself like the best are the questions. And not that I can answer all of the questions. There's a lot of questions I can't answer, and I'll be upfront about that. But receiving questions gives me an idea of what's on people's minds and what it is that they are having difficulty with, what it is that intrigues them or interests them, and so it becomes more of a dialogue. Otherwise, because I'm rather new here, I don't, and am not familiar with everybody in the room, I don't know your background, it's because of that, the questions give me a little bit of an insight as to where you're coming from and your level of familiarity and interest. So in the past, I've often started out by saying, well, I'll give a talk first and then leave questions for the end. But that invariably turns me into a liar because there is never enough time left at the end. Right? So why don't we try to do it this way, that as I'm speaking, if something comes up that you feel requires further explanation, or there's a point that you want to question, then you can raise your hand right while I'm making the presentation. And if I can, if it seems appropriate, I'll try to address that right away. If not, I'll put it off until a later time. Or I'll tell you I just don't know the answer, in which case we just forget about it. Okay. Mm. And even though this may appear to be a little bit redundant, I'd like to start by turning away from the text for a moment, for the first part of this presentation, just to give a general overview of what the Lamrim is and where it fits in to the spiritual path. Okay? And then when we turn to the text, you'll see how each of those elements are reflected in Tsongkhapa's work. Okay? So I'm doing that partly stalling for time so I can get my thoughts together. But partly because it sort of puts us all on a even footing. Those people who've already received many teachings on the Lamrim, for them it will be a review. You'll get an idea of the formation of this style of teaching. And for those of you who are new to the idea of the Lamrim or stages of the path, then it gives you a general overall introduction to begin with. So we end up more or less on the same page. Okay. So this term, Lamrim, I'm not a scholar of Sanskrit or Tibetan, but over the 40 years I've been a student, I've learned some of the words. So Lamrim, Lam means path, a spiritual path. And Rim means stages, or the graded stages of the spiritual path. And this phrase, Lamrim, has great significance because all of these teachings go back 2,500, 2,600 years by now to the time of the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni. So without going into his biography in any great depth, he was someone who was brought up as a prince in North India, and at the age of 29 he renounced the royal way of life and sought a solution to the problem of suffering and dissatisfaction. He followed very strict spiritual disciplines for a period of 6 years and practicing largely asceticism. He realized that he had been following an extreme, two extremes in his life, that before the age of 29 he was living the indulgent life of royalty, and then for the next 6 years he was basically starving himself with ascetic practices, and then at the age of 35 it occurred to him that if he was ever going to follow, to find the path that leads to the cessation of suffering and dissatisfaction, he would have to follow a middle path between self-indulgence and self-denial. And so at the age of 35, he gave up those strict ascetic practices, took his seat under a tree which became known as the Bodhi tree, or the tree of enlightenment, and achieved a full spiritual awakening while seated there. And then, from that age, from time he was 35 until he passed away at the age of 80 or 81, for all those 45 years, then he shared the spiritual insights that he had gained from this enlightenment experience with whomever he met. And this included those people who became his close followers, the various monks and then the nuns who became part of his Sangha community, and also all the ordinary lay people that he met as he wandered through the areas of North India. And so during that period of time, he gave many discourses, some of them very formal, some of them rather informal, and these were collected and memorized by his followers, and then were passed along orally for about the next 400 or 500 years, until they were written down for the first time around the dawn of the Christian era in Sri Lanka, in Ceylon. And that was the beginning of the written scriptures of the teachings of the Buddha. And it comes, in translation, this collection of the Buddhist teaching come to hundreds of volumes, for which we're very, very thankful. When you think of some of the other great, extraordinary spiritual teachers who've appeared on the earth, and we ask ourselves, how many of their actual teachings do we have? In some cases, in some of the most brilliant cases, we only have very few words. Like if you check in the Bible, for example, how many words of Jesus do we have? I think you could fit on just about 2 or 3 pages. There isn't that much, really. Yeah. But of course, we have the whole tradition that follows. But in Buddha's case, we have hundreds of teachings available to us. So we have a great wealth of spiritual instruction directly from the Buddha, and then twice that amount of the great Indian masters who followed, who added commentaries to these teachings. So the Buddhist library of scriptures, both those by the Buddha and those by his masterful followers, come to many volumes. Yeah, I was looking around. For example, all of these, everything you see here on the right and on the top and on the left, all of those aren't just decorations, those are texts. Those are Tibetan pecha. They're books. They're not bound books the way the Western do. Western cultures print books, but they're block prints of books. And these represent the teachings of the Buddha. So they come to many, many volumes. So then the question comes, well, how does somebody who wants to train in the Buddhist teachings, how does he or she approach that task? Right. What does that person study? And here I'm going to put aside a little bit the fact that the best study is to find a qualified spiritual teacher and study under that teacher, following that instructions. But just in terms of what is the order? Like if we were to take down one of these texts and just open them at random, or more to the point, if we were to take down an English translation of one of these texts and open them at random, we might pick up a discourse called sutras. We might pick up a sutra that because it was given to a certain set of disciples at a specific time for a specific reason, may not be appropriate to where we are spiritually. Right? It could be much more advanced than us, than where we are at the moment. It might concern a question which is not prominent in our mind, but something which is maybe more significant for another type of disciple. Right? Or in some cases, it might be covering material that we already feel that we know with some level of confidence. So even though we have such an extraordinary wealth of information and teachings to draw from, it isn't always immediately obvious how we can benefit from them. Right? And it's clearly beyond the capacity for someone then to just sit down and read all of it and decide how to practice on their own. That would be a monumental task. So, what happened was that over the years following the time of Shakyamuni Buddha, different great teachers appeared, and specifically I'm thinking of one whose name was Atisha, who lived 1,000 years ago. Those of you, I'm assuming that some of the people in the room here have attended one or more of the Light of the Path teachings in
Asheville?
Yes.
Asheville, yeah. I always want to say Ashland, but that's in Oregon. Yeah, Ashland is where they have the Shakespeare, the other enlightened being. Okay, so some of you have attended the teachings in Asheville, and those teachings are based on the text produced by Atisha, the Indian master I mentioned, who is very largely responsible for putting all of these teachings, all of these hundreds of volumes of teachings, in an abbreviated form, in a graded order, designed for someone to promote the spiritual practice of someone right from the beginning, when the person first expresses interest in doing something significant with their life, in a spiritual sense, all the way through the various stages leading up to the attainment of liberation and full enlightenment. So that text, the prototype for all subsequent lamrim, or stages of the past text, was Atisha's lamp to the path, or light of the path. And some hundreds of years after Atisha, then Lama Tsongkhapa, the author of this text and the founder of the tradition to which this center belongs, he wrote his commentaries to Atisha's original Lamrim text, and including in that was his very extensive treatise, which is the most extensive commentary to the Lamrim. So the particular genius, the particular special quality of Atisha's Lamp of the Path and Tsongkhapa's Lamrim text, the particular quality that's so admired by them, by those who practice, is that it lays out in a doable fashion the entire range of the spiritual path. And the particular scheme in which the Lamrim follows is based on what can be referred to as the three levels of motivation. The three levels of motivation. And what I'd like to do, and I know this will be familiar to a number of you here already, is just to give an outline of what these levels of motivation are, because this is the organizing principle behind the Lamrim. Okay. Now, actually, I'd like to start with the prequel to the Lamrim. Right. In other words, the motivation that we have before we express interest in following a spiritual path, because even nowadays, you know, if we haven't already started any kind of spiritual training, we still have a motivation in our life. So that's the pre-Lamrim motivation, which I'd like to mention first. It's not part of the Lamrim teaching, though it's implied by it. So there is a distinction that is sometimes made between worldly beings and trying to think of how the other set of beings are often referred to. If I call them spiritual beings, that doesn't sound quite right, but I'll use that term just temporarily. Between worldly beings and spiritually oriented beings, say that. All right. So on this planet of 7 billion humans, the vast majority of us could be classified as worldly beings. Even those of us, such as myself, who have studied Buddhism for 40 years, are still basically worldly beings when we check up what our real underlying motivation that carries us through the day might be. Okay? So worldly beings, ordinary beings, like, you know, like myself, like ourselves, live a life which is very largely governed by the functioning of our five physical senses, right? We are led around by our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and then the body as a whole. To put it in other terms, we seem always to be running after interesting sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and tactile sensations. So that covers the objects of the five physical senses. And not just that, in addition to that, we are more than just our five physical senses, we also have a mental sense. You know, it's what we use to think, to dream, to imagine. So we have these six sense consciousnesses, five of them based on physical aspect of our reality, where we're interested in the objects of those five senses, interesting in gathering that which is attractive sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and so forth, and interested in getting rid of or getting some distance from those objects of the senses which are unattractive or somehow or other distasteful. And if we check up carefully, we might discover, this is for each of us to find out, it's not saying that this is true because Buddha said it. We have to check out for ourselves to which extent it's true. But we spend a lot of our day going from one sensory object to the next, right? And when we get tired of one, then we switch to another, right? Lama Yeshe used to say, it's a good thing in the morning when you wake up to kind of cultivate a spiritual motivation, because otherwise the first thought you have in the morning is coffee. Where's my coffee? Right? And so we start living a coffee existence. Right? And then of course we like the coffee a certain way. Not too bland, not too sweet, not too creamy, not too strong, not too weak, like that. And then with the coffee there's something else. Maybe some kind of breakfast. And we anticipate that the experience, hoping for a taste that pleases us and being upset if the taste displeases us. And then when we're finished with that, then we might move on to another set of sensory input. So, for example, one of the things that seems to have changed a lot in my lifetime is that it seems very rare that people are separated from stimuli, especially sounds, right? That either the radio is on, the television is on, the telephone is ringing, the iPad is beeping. We're receiving constant input, advertisement and the like. So this constant input of the sound variety, so much so that we're hardly ever alone anymore. Even when we are alone, we've got a cell phone or smartphone connecting us, providing us all sorts of useless information continually. So much so that we become stimulus junkies. And we have to see, is that true? To what extent am I a stimulus junkie? To what extent do I get nervous and upset if I'm not receiving input all of the time? If it's not an interesting sight, then is it an interesting sound or a smell or a taste or a tactile sensation? And I think if we check up, we'll find to a very large extent our life is governed or directed by this incoming stimuli. But there's a big problem connected with that. Right? First of all, not all of the incoming stimuli is pleasant. Right? Just think of what you hear on the radio or listen to on the television these days in the electoral season. You know, a lot of the stuff that comes over the so-called news channels is really distasteful. No matter what our political background might be, there's just so much that's very distasteful. But that's what comes along with being stimulus junkies. We get the bad with the good. But there's a deeper problem with this constant stimulation. Even those objects, those sensory objects, which when we first perceive them are pleasant, lose their pleasant character with repetition. Just think if that's true or not. You know? Think of maybe the clearest example of this, since eating food is an absolute necessity in this life, so that's an activity we engage in many times a day, right? Think of the situation where we're eating a particular food that we like a lot, and it's well prepared, so it is tasty, okay? So whatever that food is, when it touches our tongue, it creates a sensation, and since it's food that we like, we find it pleasant. Okay. But how pleasant is that food upon repetition? You know, for the first several times we taste it, yes, it's still pleasant. But after a while, even the most pleasant experience becomes cloying, becomes too much. It starts to change into its opposite. And after a while, we might reach the stage in which we can't stand that food anymore. Right? So, none of these experiences are pleasant, continually pleasant, inherently. It all depends on the way in which we're relating to them. So if something is fresh, it might have a pleasant experience, but that pleasure very often turns to neutral and even to negative upon too much repetition. And of course we all know what happens when we eat too much of the food that we like. Then not only does it lose its interesting taste, but then also all the problems of indigestion and overweight come. So we tend to look at the objects of the five senses as something that's going to give us some form of pleasure or happiness in this life. But very, very often, we are let down. If we take those experiences in moderation, in other words, we eat just enough so that it hasn't changed to its opposite yet and then are satisfied with that, then the situation isn't so bad. But usually, our attraction to these sensory objects is such that we tend to indulge, that moderation is not part of the ordinary way in which we relate to these objects. But we're not, for instance, we're not eating for need anymore. We're eating for greed. And so one of the things we have to think about, I think, is when we are eating food or let's take the eyes. You know, we're so visually oriented. We go on trips to see new and distant and exotic landscapes, as if North Carolina weren't exotic enough, you know? So we go to different places and to see waterfalls here and mountains there and so forth, you know? And once we get tired of what we can find nationally than we go internationally. But what exactly are we gaining from those experiences? There is momentary pleasure to be had when our eyesight meets a pleasant object, right? But none of those experiences are able to withstand constant repetition. So it's as if, to go back to the eating analogy once again, it's as if we're eating, you know, our eye is eating sights, our ear is eating sounds, you know, our nose is eating smells, our tongue is eating tastes, and our body is eating tactile sensations. We're consuming all of these things. Try to fill up some kind of hunger, as if there is something missing in our lives that we think that we can get by having as many visual, audio, tactile, etc. experiences as possible. But do we ever reach a state of cessation? You know, do we ever eat a meal that is so delicious, so perfect, that we now think, well, I'm never going to have to eat again. That was perfect, you know. Or I just saw the most spectacular mountain range. I'm not going to have to look at anything else again, right? I just heard the most exquisite symphony. I'm never going to have to listen to classical music again, or whatever it is, you know. Rather, it seems that for most beings, and here, by the way, when I talk like this, I'm really talking about my own experience. So yours might be very, very different, right? But from my own experience, it's as if I'm trying to fill up a space behind these sensory experiences. You know, like when we're hungry, we're eating to fill that kind of empty space in our stomach. That's often the motivation, isn't it? We feel hunger pangs, and we're trying to get rid of those hunger pangs, so we do it by eating something, preferably something that we like, preferably something that's nutritious. Okay? So we're filling up that empty space. But I think for most, if not all beings, there's another empty space that we're trying to fill. Some meaning, some purpose in life that isn't assuaged by no matter how many delicious meals that we eat, or beautiful sights that we see, or beautiful sounds that we hear. Some years ago, I was living in England, and they had some very inventive advertisements on the TV. And one of them was for, I think it was for some alcoholic beverage. I think it could have been Guinness, you know, could have been the beer, or could have been something else. I don't quite remember. But it was apparently some really great tasting beer of some sort. And the advertisement was, it says, this beer fills up the places the others can't reach. And they were very, very inventive. For instance, it was in the form of a cartooning, animation. And in one of them you see someone and is wandering through the countryside, the beautiful English countryside. And it becomes clear after a while that this is William Wordsworth, right? Because you see he's going through a field of daffodils, right? And he's trying to put his thoughts down on paper, and it's just not working. You know, he says, I wandered by myself. No, he rips that up. He throws it away. He says, I climbed up the hill and saw the flowers. No, that's terrible. He rips that up. And, you know, he's just in this this creative impasse. And then he takes a drink of whatever that beer was that they were advertising. He takes a drink of it, and then he says, I wander lonely as a cloud that floats high over hill and dale. And he recites the daffodils like that. And then the tagline is, it says, Guinness, it reaches the place that other beers don't reach. In other words, that there's something inside. It's more than just taste. It's more than just hunger. It's like soul hunger, right? It's no longer physical hunger. It's our soul, our deepest part of our being is yearning for something more. Right? And the place that generally worldly beings like myself look for it is initially through the five physical senses. You know? And yet, no matter how wonderful and amazing and delightful they are, they never seem to reach that space of filling up that vacuity in the deepest part of our being. I'm also thinking of that song that was popular quite a number of years ago, sung by Peggy Lee, where the refrain is that all there is? And she goes through all these situations in her life, everything from the house catching on fire to falling in and falling out of love and all of these things. And she goes through all those experiences and then she says, is that all there is? You know, a feeling that life should have something more, something that's not finally satisfied, no matter how many good meals that we eat, or great movies that we watch, or fantastic books that we read, you know, or amazing plays that we attend, or extraordinary landscape that we see. Well, for that, I'm going to put an asterisk against the landscape, because the landscape can create some sense of awe, which can start to put us in touch with another level of reality. But I'm going to save that for later. Okay? But generally speaking, we look to fill up this empty space, if we feel there is such an empty space, in all sorts of ways. And if it's not filling up an empty space, then it's deadening an experience of pain. Right? Because it's kind of a two-pronged attack. You know, on one hand, it's as if we're on a scavenger hunt so that before we die, we gather as many pleasant experiences as we can, thinking that, okay, by the time we die, then we've filled out our bucket list. Are you familiar with that phrase? You know, so we've checked off this list, we've done all these things, and therefore we can die satisfied that we lived a full life. And yet, does that ever really happen? Do we ever reach a point where now I've done everything, so I'm willing to die now? Because I've completed everything that there is to complete. I've had all of the wonderful experiences. Or have even any of our wonderful experiences, as delightful as any of them have been, have they been finally satisfying? Have they finally reached that deep place? Right? So that's one approach. Let's say what we're looking to experience. The other is that this life of ours is full of ups and downs. I mean, it's such a trite expression, but it's absolutely true. I remember a Peanuts cartoon where Lucy is complaining something went wrong. And so Charlie Brown says, well, life is full of ups and downs. And Lucy says, no, it shouldn't be that way. It should be ups and ups. Right? And then she storms off, right? But despite what Lucy wants, it's always ups and downs. You know? Buddha himself said, the final end to meeting is separation. So in our life, we're constantly meeting people, many of whom we like, or meeting experiences we like, but the end result of meeting is eventual separation. So as pleasurable as it is to meet desirable objects, animate and inanimate, whatever they might be, it's also equally painful to be separated from them. And we're constantly having experiences which are not pleasurable at all, which are painful. So to adjust our life, we're not only on the scavenger hunt to collect as many pleasant experiences as possible, but also to, in a sense, anesthetize ourselves against the painful experiences. Right? So when we think, for example, all of the various types of addiction that there are in the world, and that includes not just alcohol and chemical addiction, but all the kinds of activities that we tend to engage in to kind of anesthetize ourselves against the monotony or the pain of ordinary life, none of them work either. You know, the strongest opiate may solve temporarily the bitterest pain, but after a while we need more and more to experience less and less benefit, and then of course eventually we get hooked, so what started out as medicine becomes poison and eventually kills us. Right, so it's like the cards are stacked against us. The pleasant experiences are never fully satisfying, and the experiences that we engage in to anesthetize ourselves against the unpleasant experiences tend to boomerang, tend not to do what they are advertised to do. So we seem to be moving from one unsatisfactory situation to another. Okay? So, of course, what's really important is for us to check to see if we have ever felt this way or not. Because if we've not, if up to this point our life has been hunky-dory, you know, we've had enough pleasure, we have enough avoidance of pain, things are going fine, I don't feel that empty space in the depth of my hole, in my soul that you're referring to, you know, then what I'm saying is not appropriate. But if you get a sense that you've been trying to experience some level of satisfaction or completion, you know, and that it has been elusive, then maybe there is something to what the Buddha is saying. You know, one of Buddha's own sayings, and this is, except for the fact that it's been translated into English, is, I've been told, quite an accurate rendition of what he actually said. He talked about sensory objects of desire, which is just another way of referring to those sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and tangible sensations that I was talking about before. And he said, running after sensory objects of desire is like trying to quench your thirst by drinking salt water. The more you indulge, the thirstier you become. And I think this is quite an accurate translation of what he actually said. Right? Running after sensory objects of desire is like trying to quench your thirst by drinking salt water. The more you indulge, the thirstier you become. Right? So it's very instructive, I think, to look to see what is it that we turn to when we're experiencing difficulty, dissatisfaction, uneasiness, and do the objects that we turn to have the ability to give us the measure of satisfaction or completion that we're looking for. And, you know, typically advertisers, Madison Ave, has their finger on this pulse. Very exactly. In fact, you can measure the evolution of our culture by just reviewing Coca-Cola advertisements over the last several decades. And of all of them somehow reflect this, I don't know what the German term is, the Zeitgeist. I'm probably not even pronouncing it right. Zeitgeist, right? The kind of the spirit that's in the air, you know. So there was, each time they come out with a phrase, they just catches people, you know, catches where they're at, you know. So way back in the 60s, I think it was, they had a phrase which I think was the most brilliant of all the ones that Coca-Cola advertisement ever came up with. They said, let me just think about it for a second. It's in the back of your mind. It's what you're hoping to find. Coca-Cola, it's the real thing. Then, if you remember that? Yeah? I don't know, I haven't heard it in many years. It's in the back of your mind. It's what you're hoping to find. That's what it's talking about. It's talking about this empty space that is never filled by as many beautiful sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and tangible objects that you encounter in your life. It's this hunger that we have. It's in the back of our mind. We can't quite put our finger on it. You know, we're hoping to find it, but thank God there's Coca-Cola, because Coca-Cola is going to satisfy that. You know? It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. When Lama Yeshe came to the United States for the first time, one of the first things he said was, the advertisers here are brilliant psychologists. They really understand psychology. They understand how to catch the mind. Of course, the motive behind that is just then to sell you something. It's not so that hunger, that deep soul hunger, if I can call it that, you know, that's driving all of this, can actually be taken care of, assuaged, completed, so that we can live a life of true satisfaction. It's just to have us buy something, you know, for profit. But it catches on that same wish. In fact, some advertisements, when you think of it, they don't even have the product that they're selling. Sometimes it doesn't appear at all. Or just appears very briefly for a second at the end. Rather, the whole rest of the advertisement is a movie which is a glimpse of heaven, right? A glimpse of heaven on earth. You know, people just enjoying themselves tremendously, one way or the other. And so you get attracted to this vision. Oh, that's life. That's nice. I'd like to have that. I'd like to have, you know, a family in which all the members of the family are attractive and smiling and laughing, you know, and all the house is filled with rich furnishings, and that just seems perfect. How do I get that? How can I enter into that dream that's being displayed? And then it comes, you know, he says, well, you use this brand of toothpaste, or you buy this car, or something like that. So it gives an image, a heavenly, almost impossible nirvanic image of wonderment, in order, because that's what we're hoping to find. Or that gives us a hint of what's in the back of our mind. And then, of course, it's, what is that, the selling technique? Bait and switch? Is that what it's called? Right? So they bait you with this image, and then they switch you to Coca-Cola or toothpaste or a Mercedes-Benz or whatever it happens to be. You know? So why am I going on at such length of this? Maybe because I have nothing else to say. But maybe it's because I think, and I'm going a little bit out on a limb here, I think all of us and that's all 7 billion of us, are on a spiritual quest. In other words, we're living a life with this body and this mind, feeling somehow or other incomplete or fragmented. And what's really in the back of our mind, what we're really hoping to find, is some kind of integration. You know, some kind of connectedness. Some kind of sense or meaning out of our life. But we tend to be oriented in our search towards external objects. Right? We have a what we could think of as an if-only mentality, right? If only I had a nicer house to live in, then I'd be satisfied, then I'd be happy. If only my life partner treated me nicer, then I'd be happy. If only my boss gave me a raise, or move me into an office near the windows, then I'd be happy. If only this, if only that. And we tend to think of our life as a matter of arranging and rearranging the furniture of our life, the external affairs of our life. And for some people, it actually literally is rearranging the furniture. You know, you go into their house one day, things are set up one way, you go 2 days later, and they've rearranged all the living room furniture because they feel that's going to be better, that's going to make me happier. And it makes them happier for a day, and then the next day they change something else. I know people like this, you know. But it isn't just that furniture, like house furniture. It's furniture in the sense of all the things that make up our life, all the external phenomena. You know, if we get tired of listening to one kind of music, we might get rid of all of those CDs and start buying another whole type of music, thinking this is going to satisfy, you know, or books, or movies, or food, or whatever it is, thinking that somehow or other, if only I could just get that right, you know, set it up just the right way that I'd want it, then I'd get up and I would never fall down again. But that patently is not true, you know. And one of the easiest ways of seeing that it's not true is just to go into neighborhoods where everyone is wealthy. And it looks from the outside all shiny and clean and beautiful and very nice, very pleasant. And then you just talk to the people who live there. And their conversation is as filled with mental anguish and dissatisfaction as the conversation of someone who's living in a slum. And in some sense, even worse. In some sense, even worse. Because they know they have it made. Right? The people in the slum may think, well, yeah, my life isn't very good, but if I were to move to Beverly Hills, then it would be great. You know? But then if you actually go to Beverly Hills, and then you see what the people's lives are like when they actually talk about it truthfully, you see that they have the same kind of mental anguish that everyone does. Right? So arranging and rearranging the external furniture of the life doesn't work. I'm saying that kind of dogmatically, but it shouldn't be taken dogmatically. It should be taken as something we investigate, you know, because maybe there is something that you find truly satisfying, truly soul-satisfying. Okay. So aside, you know, I said, you know, we could divide the world in a sense between worldly and spiritual. So what does it mean then to follow a spiritual way of life? I've always been intrigued by that question, and Lama Yeshe answered it once very, very simply. He said, spiritual is when you start taking a real interest. That's the World Series. That's true pleasure. I just found out, just before I came here, that the World Series went to the seventh game. I thought it was going to be over earlier. So.
The game hasn't started yet.
It hasn't started?
No?
Okay.
If only the Cubs would win.
Yeah, that's right. Then we'll be happy. Oh, yeah. Mama Yeshe. So he once said, you start showing an interest in the spiritual path or the spiritual side of life when you take great interest in the workings of the mind. Okay? So if in the worldly sense our efforts are largely a matter of arranging and rearranging the external furniture of our life, you know, the sensory objects and so forth, right? Then the spiritual path is one in which we're investigating what's actually going on internally. You know, what attitude are we bringing to our life? And that seems to be a truism from the Buddhist point of view, that it is the attitude with which we experience something which is the prime determining factor as to whether we derive benefit and even pleasure from that object or not. It's not, it doesn't lie in the object itself. I'm going to rephrase that because even I didn't quite understand what I just said. We may think, for example, I like ice cream, you know, a vanilla ice cream cone, very simple tastes, right? I may think that the pleasure of licking a vanilla ice cream cone abides in the ice cream. And certainly the ice cream is the stimulus that touches my tongue. There's no denying that, you know. But in terms of experiencing that as pleasurable, right? The main determining factor for that is not the quality of the ice cream, but the mental attitude that I'm having towards it. Right? I used the example of the other day, but a lot of you weren't here, of going to enjoy a Thanksgiving dinner, getting into a political argument beforehand, and then the food losing its taste. Right? Not because there was anything wrong with the taste, but because I was in such a foul state of mind that I couldn't enjoy food which was in fact delicious. Right? So the ice cream cone, if I were to eat it with excessive greed, you know, in a state of being very upset with anger, that would not have any ability at all to even begin to satisfy me. It wouldn't even taste pleasant. All I might do is reach my dissatisfaction with it quicker. Like, if I eat an ice cream cone in a good state of mind, it takes me quite a while until I get sick of it. You know, I will enjoy it for quite a while until I reach a point where I'll say, no more. That's cloying. That's too much. That's too sweet. You know. But if I eat that ice cream cone in a foul state of mind, I reach that sense of being fed up with it rather quickly. Right? So it's not the pleasure or the happiness that can be derived from an experience does not derive mainly from the object itself, but from the attitude with which we approach it. That's why earlier I said, as a kind of an aside, if we can approach our dealing with sensory objects with a certain level of moderation, which is taking into account the fact that if we overindulge, we will stop enjoying it. So we just stop indulging before we reach that point. So that's moderation. Then we can move from one thing to another with a certain amount of equanimity. But if our entire direction that we hope to find satisfaction in our life from is externally oriented, then that satisfaction can't be found, because it doesn't exist primarily in the objects itself, but in the mind. And so once we take interest in cultivating our mind, in, first of all, discovering that our mind is not a monolith. We use mind as a singular noun, you know, my mind, right? As if it's one thing, right? But the mind is anything but one thing, right? It's constantly changing states of mind, one after the other. One Tibetan Lama who was obviously very impressed when he came to Europe and saw one of these great train stations, maybe in Paris or one of those other large centers. And afterwards, when he gave teachings, he said, well, the mind is like one of those great train stations with trains pulling in and pulling out all the time. You know, thoughts, emotions, ideas, anticipations, judgments, one after the other, one replacing the other, continually, right? So we might talk about something as mind, as a collective noun, but what we're talking about is an ever-changing, a kaleidoscope of mental events. And within these mental events, some of them actually have some beneficial aspect to them. In other words, when we are experiencing those states of mind, there's a measure of peace. There's a measure of satisfaction. Whereas there's other states of mind, when they arise, bring dissatisfaction in their wake. Often immediately, and even those that don't bring it immediately, bring it after a while. And so when we start paying attention to the mind, we realize that it is impermanent, that it's changing all the time, that some of the elements that arise are peaceful and beneficial and helpful, virtuous, we could say, and others are destructive and harmful, and that we actually have the ability, though it isn't always immediately obvious that we do, to, you know, in the words of that Johnny Mercer song, of accentuating the positive and eliminating the negative, right? A lot of times people don't feel that. We don't feel that. We feel, you know, someone says, you really have a short temper. You get angry very quickly. And then, you know, of course, we don't like to be insulted, so we punch the guy in the nose. But even if we refrain from doing that, we say, yeah, I guess you're right, but that's just the way I am. I was just born that way. It's probably in my chromosomes. Mm-hmm. Right? So we either don't notice the bad habits that we have, right? I speak from experience. Or we notice them but feel it's such an inherent, ingrained part of our being that we're powerless to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. But because the mind is impermanent, because it is changing moment by moment, we in fact do have the ability to eliminate the negative. Well, we can't start by eliminating the negative qualities of the mind, but we can start withdrawing from them. In other words, turning down the energy, right? Weaning ourselves away from it. And eventually, and this is quite a great accomplishment, eventually possible to eliminate it. When Buddha gave his first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, the third noble truth was, no matter how powerfully destructive a delusion or an affliction might be, it is possible to experience its cessation. Right? The cessation of suffering. Now, he said that because he actually experienced it. The reason his disciples followed it is because he taught ways for them to experience it as well, so that they it wasn't just a matter of taking the Buddha's word for it, right? But there was instructions, there was methods that he imparted. So, to go back to how this theme started 45 minutes ago or more. Oh no, an hour and 15 minutes ago, sorry. The Lamrim is based on a set of motivations, three in number. This prequel, the worldly set of motivations, is what I've been talking about. In other words, before we meet the Dharma, and Dharma is just a term for the spiritual path, like the Buddha Dharma, right? Before we actually meet the Dharma teaching, right? Then we are following our own Dharma. We are following our own path, but we're most likely following a path as was described, in which we're running after sensory objects of desire, hoping that we can arrange the externals of our life in such a way that we can find the elusive peace and well-being that we're looking for. Okay? So we start moving into the sphere of the spiritual practice when we realize that is not sufficient, because it doesn't matter what we do on that level. It never brings the final satisfaction and completion that we're looking for. So instead, we start looking inwardly. And one of the reasons that people who follow a spiritual path are called inner beings, one of the reasons that is sometimes given for that phrase, inner being, is because they're inner-oriented. It doesn't mean that they pay no attention to external phenomena. That's part of our life. It's something we definitely have to deal with. But the main focus is what is going on the inside, because that is the main determining factor that that colors our experience. Okay. So when we start taking an interest in the spiritual path, that's when we start the possibility of progressing through these three levels of spiritual motivation that the Lamrim talks about, that Atisha outlined in his original Lamrim text, and that it's explained in all of the other commentaries. I do want to repeat, because something I said briefly, but I want to emphasize, we shouldn't think that before the time of Atisha, these teachings didn't exist. All these teachings existed from the time of the Buddha and the other great masters who followed him. But one of Atisha's particular geniuses was the way he arranged it for the individual for the practice of an individual being. Right? We have now an idea, maybe too much of an idea, maybe I talk too much, about the worldly Dharma. And actually, there is that phrase. That phrase does exist in the teachings. They talk about the eight worldly dharmas, right? Or the eight worldly concerns. Usually, we use dharma in reference to some kind of a spiritual pursuit, the Buddha Dharma or the Christian Dharma or the Dharma of love or something like that. But here, when we say the eight worldly dharmas, we're talking about the concerns of a worldly being. And have you heard that expression before, the eight worldly concerns? Or the eight worldly dharmas, right? These are four sets of pairs, right? Just to give you an example, we are looking to experience pleasure and to avoid pain. You know, to receive praise and to avoid blame. You know, we're happy when things are going well. We're unhappy when things are not going well, you know. We like fame. We want to avoid disgrace. So these are like four pairs. One element in each pair is positive, what we're looking to gain, praise, material objects, riches and so forth, gain. And one is the negative, what we're looking to avoid, avoiding loss, avoiding disgrace, avoiding poverty, etc., etc. Okay? And for when we're existing on the ordinary worldly level of being, then this is basically our pursuit. You know, running after, just to take one, running after pleasure and avoiding pain. Okay? But when we realize that that is just another version of continually arranging and rearranging the external furniture of our life, which never brings true satisfaction, then there seems to be two possibilities open to us. One is despair. Right? There are people who've tried everything. None of it's worked. And so they move into a syndrome of self-destructive behavior. Right? And a lot of addictive behavior is based on that. People commit suicide. Things like that. I grew up in New Jersey, and even then, at that time, I knew that there was a lot of places in the world much more attractive than New Jersey. And eventually moved to California, which is much more attractive. Right? But then there are people there who are not satisfied, so then they move to Hawaii or Tahiti. You know, and when you're there, it is beautiful. It's incredibly beautiful. Right? I don't like the mosquitoes, but Tahiti is an incredibly beautiful place. Right? But when I was there once, time after time, when people started speaking to me, and these were mostly French people who had left France and took an assignment in Tahiti, a very well-paid assignment in beautiful surroundings, they had all of the same problems that people in California, North Carolina, and New Jersey have. All the same. But there was something even more exquisitely painful for them because they knew there was no other more beautiful place that they could move to. Right? Like when you're in New Jersey and you're miserable, you can blame it on New Jersey. But when you've found the place which is your ideal of beauty and you're still miserable, you still don't have a happy life, then what's it to blame on? You know, there's nothing you can blame it on, right? And so that's when real despair happens, real self-destructive behavior happens. So that's one alternative. That's obviously not the recommended alternative, but it's the one that many people follow, isn't it? You know, like in the poem Richard Cory, who went home, rich guy, went home and put a bullet through his head. Right? Okay. The other alternative is then to become an inner explorer, to explore the inner workings of the mind. And then just to give a summary, and this will be more like kind of an introduction to next week, when I might actually get into the subject matter of this poem. When we start looking inwardly, one of the things we discover, and we see what's making up these ever-changing aspects of our mind, we discover that present within them are certain mental states which have a truly destructive quality to them. You know? We don't have to wait until we experience their karmic results. They're experienced as destructive and harmful the moment they arise. For example, hatred. You know? There's few people of the ordinary worldly persuasion, you know, few of the 7 billion people on this planet who don't have moments of intense anger or hatred arising in the mind. All you have to do is be crossed. All you have to do is have some desire thwarted. And it's very easy for that to become irritation, which leads to anger, which leads to hatred. Right? a conversation with a friend that turns sour, a disagreement, and suddenly hatred arises and we lose a friendship. And so we start noticing that among the elements that make up this ever-changing kaleidoscope of our mind, some of them are very negative, very destructive. Hatred is probably one of the best ones to think about because it is so obviously destructive. There's other ones which seem to be attractive on the surface. Their destructive quality only becomes clear upon reflection. But nobody is happy the moment they're on fire with rage, right? And it's something you can see easily with other people, right? Sometimes harder to see for oneself. But when you see someone else, like you're out shopping and there's someone in the store with you, and maybe it's a man and he's lost his temper at a salesperson or at a member of this family, and he starts getting angry and the voice gets loud, and then pretty soon the complexion starts turning red and starts shaking, right? And you see that when the Buddhist teachings call hatred an affliction, it's a perfectly apt term. It's affliction. It's like a disease. The person had a normal face before then, it was good color to it, right? And body was functioning well, and now the body is shaking, the face is turning red, you know, everything's squinched up. It's clearly an affliction. And yet some of us become so accustomed to being hair trigger with our temper and so forth that we think it's an integral part of our being. Why? If I didn't get angry all the time, people would just take advantage of me. That's a philosophy a lot of people have, whether they express it or not. And yet, what happens if we indulge in that kind of hatred, that kind of anger, that kind of rage? Well, clearly, the prevalence of heart disease and cancer and ulcers and things like that are a direct byproduct of giving way to that afflictive state of mind. It doesn't only harm the mind, it harms the body that mind is encased in. And if we go through the list of the various afflictions, jealousy and arrogance and so forth, we can see that each of them has this afflictive quality, this delusional quality to it. Instead of making us feel happier, it makes us feel more and more miserable. And then we start to discover that these states of mind, and I'll stay with strong anger, strong hatred, I'll stay with that one, that these states of mind not only make us miserable when they arise, at the moment of their arisal, but they do something far worse. Right? They have consequences in our future experience. So, for example, if we get really angry at someone, not just disliking something they did, but that kind of hateful type of anger towards that person, very often it gets expressed by saying something particularly nasty or harsh to that person. Or if it's even stronger than that, there might be a physical action that follows, right? Like hitting or stealing or doing something to harm that person. Now, when we engage in that kind of action based on those afflictions, clearly it harms the recipient of that action, the person that we lie to, the person we use the harsh language to, the person that we hit, the person that we steal from. That obviously has a negative effect. But that isn't the worst negative effect, right? According to the Buddhist teachings, each time we indulge in a strong affliction like that, and especially if we reinforce it by expressing it verbally or physically, it leaves an impression on our own seat of consciousness, on our own stream, our own mind stream, like that. And as we carry those impressions along with us, they eventually, like a seed, sprout when conditions are met with. And the general rule that we can begin to discover for ourselves after a period of reflection is that if we plant a seed on our consciousness in a state of affliction, like hatred, the ripening of that seed is an experience of pain, of unhappiness. Whereas we also, in our daily experience, plant favorable seeds on our consciousness, right? When we're motivated by, instead of hatred, when we're motivated, let's say, by compassion, the wish to help someone, the wish to make someone happy, the wish to help someone over their problems. If we engage in an action with that kind of motivation, that also plants a seed, but because that was positive and virtuous, that we're doing for others what we would love to have happen to ourselves, right? Experiencing happiness as opposed to unhappiness, then when that seed ripens, it's in an experience of well-being. Okay? So this is a very slow, perhaps torturous way of getting into just the first of the three levels of motivation that the Lamrim is built upon. And that is a recognition that within the field of our conscious experience, there are some elements which are negative and destructive, which set us up for experiencing suffering, not only as those states of mind arise, but as we experience their ripened results in the future. So the first level of spiritual motivation then, from this Lamrim point of view, is to take care of our future. And we shouldn't think that taking care of our future means to neglect the present moment. Some people say that. They say, oh, you spiritual practitioners, you're always thinking about the future, but the present is what's important. And certainly in Zen Buddhism, there's a very strong emphasis of that. You know, everything is found in the present moment, right? And all of that's true. But taking care of the future in this sense is to pay attention to the present moment. It isn't to turn a blind eye to what's happening in the present. It's to be very careful of what's happening in the present state of mind, because it will have consequences now and in the future. Right? So thinking about future consequences is not to deny the present moment, it's to take a special close look at the present moment, right? And see what is arising now which is going to create happiness for myself in the future, and what, if I don't curtail it, is just going to cause even more suffering in the future. Okay? So this, finally, begins to talk about the first of the three levels of spiritual motivation in which the Lamrim is constructed around. So I think that's enough. I think that's probably more than enough for the first session, even though I didn't get into the heart of the matter. Somehow I felt that that kind of background puts the Lamrim in the proper perspective. I might be wrong on this, and maybe next week no one will show up. So, then that's my fault. But hopefully it gives us an idea of what direction these spiritual teachings are taking, how it's moving away from merely paying attention to the external aspects of our life, and is taking a deep interest in what's happening within our mind, because it's on that level that we can make a real difference in how we live our lives. And eventually create experiences of happiness, peace, and well-being for ourselves. And then it serves as the basis for the even higher levels of spiritual motivation, which, with any luck, we'll get into next week. Okay? Now, we've reached the time when I'm supposed to stop, and I am happy to stop, but I didn't leave any time for questions, but no question was asked during the teaching as well. But I don't want to dismiss us if there's someone who has something really, really vitally important to bring up. I don't want to add the frustration of my talking nonstop for an hour and a half to the frustration of not being able to ask a real important question. So if there is a real burning question, does anyone want to ask? If not, yes, thank you.
Not a question.
Oh, good.
I'll just say that... Oh.
It's not a question, but I will just say that growing up in New Jersey, I had the joy of the sand dunes and the pine barrens and the Delaware Water Gap and all the fresh vegetables and fruits that I could ever want. So New Jersey to me was a heaven.
And that's a really, really good example of the whole gist of what I was talking about in the beginning. Is that the pleasure or pain doesn't derive in the object, because the object has many aspects to it. I myself was brought up within smelling distance of Secaucus. That was my New Jersey, right? The New Jersey Turnpike, you know? When people make jokes, like one joke I heard recently was, why are people in New York often so depressed, New York City often so depressed, because for them the light at the end of the tunnel is New Jersey. And what they mean is it's the caucus, you know, it's the turnpike. I didn't see the Delaware Water Gap or the further reaches of the Jersey shore until I basically was leaving New Jersey. Right? So for me, New Jersey was New Jersey, right? Where the Soprano families hang out. They go to the Pine Barrens to do some of their murders, but they live, you know, they live near the Turnpike. Okay. Well, good. That was a good question. Okay. I want to thank you very much for your patience. I know I went in several possibly misleading directions, but there could be some positive energy generated even with this kind of strange approach, simply because we tried to cultivate a good motivation in the beginning. And then during it, we try to check to see whether the things that were being said accord with our situation or not, with our experience or not. And that that attempt to stay with an explanation, to see if it's relative, that in and of itself is positive. It creates a positive energy. So in order for whatever positive energy we may have generated, individually or collectively, by the the hour and a half that we spent together, in order for that not to be dissipated or destroyed, it is very helpful at the conclusion to dedicate. So if there has been any positive energy generated by us, collectively or individually, then it's good to dedicate it, taking the example of the great spiritual practitioners, the great Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the past, who, when they dedicate the virtuous merit of their positive actions, they do so with a deep understanding that nowhere within the realm of the dedication, either the person making the dedication, who the dedication is for, or the very act of dedication, that none of these three spheres of dedication have even one atom of concrete self-existence, but are all dependent arisings, mere appearances to the mind. And with that deep understanding, then we may dedicate even a small positive energy so that all beings may be released from their mental and physical sufferings. So that those spiritual masters, such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Kepchi Sopa Rinpoche, and many others, both inside and outside the Buddhist fold, teaching true paths to higher rebirth, liberation, and enlightenment, may be endowed with long and fruitful lives, so that we ourselves may come under the benevolent care of such compassionate teachers in this and in all our future states of existence, so that the enlightened beings inhabiting every corner of the universe continue to turn the peerless wheel of the Dharma, and so that we ourselves may complete our spiritual path as swiftly as possible in order to be able to repay the infinite kindness we've received from each and every being. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I know it's customary in a situation like this, out of respect for the teachings, for people to let the teacher leave first. But these days, it takes me a while to stand up. By that time, you'll probably be asleep. So please leave at your own speed. Thank you.